buildings that will now be sold at great profit, while their minimal, meager social programs will now be cut by a government that was never elected. And so there's a lot of anger and a lot of disillusionment and a lot of resentment about what the aftermath of the Olympics will likely entail for the people who are in the greatest need.
Glenn, I want to thank you for being with us. I want to ask you to stay for just 5 minutes after the show. We'll do a post-show and post it online at democracynow.org. Glenn Greenwald is the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, one of the founding editors of The Intercept, recently helped launch The Intercept Brazil in Portuguese to cover Brazilian social and political news. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Tarina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Maria Barnard, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godarz, Anthony Manzo, and Carl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Craig-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ailey. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KABU was born. After 48 years, KABU Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KABU is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.
KABU's membership drive is coming up in September. Help us promote the work of this amazing station by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and now Snapchat, rating our app on the iTunes and Google Play Store, and joining our Facebook event for the upcoming membership drive. Oh, and don't forget to join or renew your membership. Just click donate on our website or app and start your monthly contribution to your community radio, KBOO.
The time is 5.02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
And coming up on the KABU Evening News, tensions build as the city of Portland continues with its plan to close the Springwater Corridor to campers beginning this Thursday.
Companies at Portland Harbor are challenging the City of Portland's decision to place a homeless shelter in the Terminal 1 building on Northwest Front Avenue.
And state election websites may be targeted by hackers, according to a flash alert released earlier this month by the FBI that was leaked to the media earlier today. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, August 29th, 2016. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Natasha Delapine. Tensions are building as the city of Portland continues with its plan to close the Springwater Corridor to campers beginning this Thursday. There are believed to be more than 250 people living in the corridor located in southeast Portland, and dozens of the homeless campers are objecting to the planned eviction, saying they have nowhere else to go. Several Lentz neighborhood residents and the area restaurants are also protesting the city's decision, claiming it will force the homeless into area neighborhoods which are unprepared for the influx. Several weeks ago, city officials posted more than 1,000 notices on tents and living areas in the Springwater Corridor, and now believe up to 75% have already vacated the area.
A coalition of companies at Portland Harbor are challenging the city of Portland's decision to place a homeless shelter in the Terminal 1 building on Northwest Front Avenue. On August 2nd, the city council voted 3-2 to approve a plan to operate a temporary homeless shelter at the city-owned 14-acre Terminal 1 port site. Nick Fish, the commissioner who oversees the bureau that owns the building, doesn't believe the lease will hold up to legal challenges, saying it violates the bureau's own regulations and the recently adopted comprehensive plan. This challenge to the proposed homeless shelter is the second to be publicly announced. It joins a suit filed by an attorney representing several Portland Water Bureau ratepayers who claim the lease is well under market value and therefore illegal.
Congress designated August 26th Women's Equality Day in 1971 to mark the 19th Amendment, a law that guarantees women the right to vote. Though the amendment was passed more than a century ago, Rebecca Gladstone, a vice president for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, says there's still some progress to be made for women. KBOO's Layla Yao filed this story last Friday in cooperation with the Oregon News Service.
It's Women's Equality Day, a holiday proclaimed by Congress in 1971 to celebrate the passage of the 19th Amendment, which ensured women the right to vote in 1920. While progress has been made over the last century, Rebecca Gladstone, vice president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, says women still have further to go. She says women these days have to fight the perception that they've cleared every hurdle so the next generation can experience full equality.
There is still some discrimination. There are glass ceilings. There are pay disparities. I have two daughters. I think there's still some achievement that has yet to happen.
In Oregon, women make 82 cents for every dollar men make, according to the Oregon Center for Public Policy. The gap is greater for women of color. African American women make 70 cents, Native American women make 62 cents, and Latina women make 51 cents for every dollar made by a white man. Gladstone says voters in Oregon don't face the same restrictions as in many other states, such as voter ID laws. The Beaver State has a vote-by-mail system and also the new voter motor law, which automatically registers anyone getting a driver's license at the DMV. She says now Oregon women can look forward to getting voters engaged in the election.
Now that we have the vote and we have this great voter registration system that's coming into fruition even better than predicted, we're working on informing voters.
Data from the Oregon Motor Voter Program shows more than 220,000 voters have been added to the rolls since the beginning of this year. Gladstone notes even before the motor voter law, Oregon ranked 5th in the nation for voter turnout and 8th for voter registration. For KBOO News, this is Layla Yao.
After decades of defunding Oregon schools, the lack of money is leading to larger classroom sizes and lower graduation rates, according to a new report. KBOO's Jamani Ward Lewis reports in cooperation with the Oregon News Service.
Decades of shrinking budgets for Oregon's public schools has led to some of the largest class sizes and lowest graduation rates in the country, according to a new report. Along with a statewide study of Oregon's many funding gaps in education, authors of the report at Oregon Education Association compared Salem, Massachusetts, one of the better-funded school districts in the country, with Salem, Oregon. Funding per student in the Beaver State's capital trailed by more than $6,000. John Scott, who is a middle school teacher in Salem, Oregon, says large school sizes especially have taken a toll on students' education.
It's a challenge when it comes to your class management, just managing all those kids, all those bodies, all those personalities. It's a challenge when it comes to that one-on-one opportunity with students, from students who need additional help and students who need the opportunity to be challenged in a one-on-one way.
On average, there are 10 more students in Salem, Oregon classrooms compared with Salem, Massachusetts, according to the report. Oregon's graduation rate also lags behind the Bay State by 10%. Oregon ranks 35th in the nation for school funding. Hannah Vandering, president of the Oregon Education Association, says schools' dwindling budgets have also affected elective classes, which are important to student engagement.
It's made us make decisions that don't offer programs like PE, music, art, career and technical, those things that excite students and inspire them to learn.
Infrastructure funding is lacking as well. A 2014 task force found that Oregon schools have more than $7 billion in deferred maintenance costs, according to the state's education funding model. Schools face a $2 billion gap over the next 2 years. Scott says an initiative on this year's ballot, Measure 97, which would tax businesses that make more than $25 million in Oregon sales, 2.5%, could be the answer to the school's funding problems. Critics say the tax from the new measure will be handed down to consumers. However, Scott believes it is businesses' duty to invest in schools.
We expect mom and pop shops and then everyone else to invest in our education system through our taxes paid. The folks that are making $25 million or more, they should invest in our students' futures as well.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
Portland's annual hemp stock, marijuana legalization protest, and music festival will go ahead as planned in spite of recent bad financial news. Empower Healthcare Corporation, which operates medical marijuana card clinics in several states, has withdrawn its support of the event in according to the company's founder, Paul Stanford. The company also withdrew its support of Seattle Hemp Fest last month, notifying organizers of that decision just 2 weeks before the event. Empower was the for-profit company that operated the clinic business and which previously provided funds to the nonprofits Stanford operated that, among other things, run Hempstock. To learn more, earlier today, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke to Paul Stanford.
My name is Paul Stanford, and I am wearing my hat for the Portland Hempstock Festival right now, I guess.
Now, Paul, Portland Hempstock comes up in September here shortly. What days? And it's at Waterfront Park again this year, right?
Yes, it's at Waterfront Park in the bowl there at the west end of the Hawthorne Bridge there in Tom McCall Waterfront Park, just off Mado Parkway, next to the marina. And it is September 24th and 25th, Saturday, September 24th, and Sunday, September 25th.
Looking forward to it again as usual. Now, the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, the Campaign for the Restoration and Regulation of Hemp, those are the nonprofits which you've been working with for decades now, I think. And those are still involved in Hempstock, correct?
That's right. That's right. I have been the subject of a hostile takeover with my clinic business, which split off from the nonprofit several years ago. So they are currently, after a 15-minute ex parte court hearing, in the hands of some Canadian investors.
My understanding is that they're responsible for the decision to withhold funding from last weekend's Hemp Fest up in Seattle, correct?
That's right. We had a long-term commitment to be the presenting sponsors of Hemp Fest. We had been the only presenting sponsors the Seattle Hemp Fest has had in its history. And so this is a group of Canadian investors. They've come in and actually taken our medical records out of the country and to a foreign Canadian Toronto marijuana data company called Ample Organics.
The big question really has to be, will this takeover impact hemp stock at all? I mean,
there's some resources that my clinic had devoted to, you know, being the presenting sponsor of the Portland Hempstock Festival. So just like Seattle Hemp Fest had to happen without our support, the Portland Hempstock Festival isn't going to get support from my clinics this year. But we have other sponsors and other vendors. And so the Hempstock Festival is going ahead of its own entity.
Well, this is good news. This is great news. The show will go on then.
The show must go on. That's the old adage, and in this case, it's certainly true. You know, the past 2 years, 2014 and 15, we couldn't get the city park people to even give us a permit. We had to go before the
city council and the mayor and have them override the parks department. This year, fortunately, we have an agreement, a permit in process since January, or actually before that. So we've had our dates for 9 months now. So we've had proper planning, but we've had some financial juggling. But that's the way it always is with these festivals. So we're going back to the waterfront. It's a free event down at the waterfront. There aren't any fences or any gate that you have to go through to be at this event. So there's no searches or anything, but it is, because we're on the public parks property, a non-smoking event. And so we're trying to get a designated smoking area set up, just like the Blues Festival does when they're in that same space. But time will tell.
KBOO is a sponsor of, is a co-sponsor of the Hempstalk Festival there at Waterfront Park, the 24th and 25th. So we'll be there. And looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. Paul, the best of luck with everything. Any closing thoughts? By the way, any closing thoughts for the listeners? And where can people find out more, get schedule information, that kind of thing?
Again, it is Saturday, September 24th, and Sunday, September 25th. And the place to find all the information is hempstalk.org. That's H-E-M-P-S-T-A-L-K, just like hempstalk.
Terrific. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Street Books is known around the world as Portland's library for people who live outside. But it's more than that, and the organization's annual fundraiser is coming up this week. Here to talk about the project with us is founder Laura Moulton.
Hi.
And Diana Rempe.
Hi.
Laura and Diana, thank you so much for being with us here tonight. So first off, can you just tell us, what is Street Books?
Yeah, Street Books is a bicycle-powered mobile library serving people who live outside in Portland. We have been going since 2011, and we have expanded in the last year to two bicycles. We serve areas all over the city, including the Workers' Center on Martin Luther King Boulevard, Hazelnut Grove in North Portland, and a number of new sites this summer.
Okay, so how does it work? Do you simply decide on locations where you know there will be folks needing your services, and then you just go there on a regular schedule?
That's right. We show up same place, same time each week. We have an old school card and pocket system where people sign out books and leave us that card. So we kind of track how many books go out. They receive a business size card that says Street Books. We write their name in the line and kind of do a handshake, and that's our exchange. So that's as official as they need to be. They never have to show us proof of ID or proof of address.
And there's never, just to add, there's never ever any fines or any problem if they lose a book.
Yeah. How did you start this project?
You know, I got a grant from RAC, from Regional Arts and Culture Council, in 2011. And I wanted to do something to reach out to the community that I saw at the time. When I first moved to Portland, I lived in inner southeast, very close to KBOO. And there were a number of people at St. Francis that I would have conversations with. I had a conversation with a guy who went by Quiet Joe about books, and we had the writer A.B. Guthrie in common. And I realized that my mind had been kind of blown from that conversation. And if that was the case, I thought something could be made of that in terms of an art project.
So was this individual, and among many others, the inspiration for the project to be started?
I think so, yeah. I think that sense of what could happen in a conversation about books, and then what could happen when people were maybe experiencing hard times but could have books as a resource.
How are those resources available to them, and which authors are available this summer?
Well, I think Diana can speak to that.
Well, so to begin with, all of our books are donations. And so people give us lots and lots of paperbacks, and we fill the cart as the bikes as needed. Sometimes we get hardback books, but we can't carry them on the bike because it's too heavy. So we actually sell those and get the credit to buy paperback requests that we get, because our patrons will ask us for books and we'll try to get them to them the next week. And then you asked about what kinds of books are going out all the time. So it really varies from year to year and from shift to shift. And this year, as we've become much more, we've moved really all over the city. We've got six shifts happening every day, just about during the summer. And so there's a variety of books that go out. So people love graphic novels, but people also, one of my patrons checked out Great Expectations by Dickens this week. So, you know, there's this range of literary taste. I started going up to an encampment right by the Rose Quarter called Speak Thunder. It's been there for quite some time, pretty small, and it's grown a bit, and it's mostly Native American folks. And some of the readers there, like this week, one guy took contemporary Native American stories and a Sherman Alexie book. And so, you know, it's a really wide variety of books that changes every week.
Are you primarily getting these from bookstores, individuals?
Well, we get books from individuals. That's where our donations come from, and from Multnomah County Library. They give us a little box of books, like once a month.
Yeah.
You know, and then we have some really lovely people, like a woman who comes down to St. Francis almost every week this summer, bringing books from her book group that she's collected. And so just things like that.
So over the last few years, as the homeless population here in Portland has grown significantly, aside from adding new locations, how has street books been forced to change?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure we have expanded in terms of adding librarians. One of the things that was our long-term goal that we've begun to achieve this summer is employing people who have had a past stretch of time outside, and I think bring greater insight because they've lived outside before. And Ben Hodgson, who I met as a patron in 2011, is now running a shift on Mondays. So he is a longtime, very important part of the Street Books project. And because of his years as an outdoorsman, he's a self-proclaimed outdoorsman. I think that he knows exactly where people are coming from and what they might need on any given day. And so he's had a hugely successful shift on Mondays at 6th and Burnside. And he's been taking requests. Today he called me. He'd checked out 30 books this morning and got a copy of a Shakespeare book to a guy who was really interested. So Ben is an incredible reader and an incredible resource. But that's an example. I think being able to pull in and create a community of people who have had experience outside and people who love books altogether has been a powerful part of that this summer.
How many volunteers do you have about in your community?
Well, we have, you want to say something about that?
Well, I really want to clarify that our librarians are paid. And so when we are, you know, they're paid hourly, and certainly we're not offering a whole lot of hours, but we are,
right.
We try really hard to provide a livable wage and pay people for the work that they do as librarians. And that's part of the Street Books. That's part of our mission, is to make sure that we can do that. And so we have lots of amazing volunteers, but our librarians are all paid.
Mm-hmm. And we have, I would say, somewhere between 10 and 20 volunteers, depending on what, it's kind of seasonal. We have an event with Sisters of the Road in February. Summers are really cooking. We're going to have a house party for the first time this year. There's a retired librarian who's really excited to host a gathering for us and see if we can earn a little bit of money that way. Or raise money. So it really kind of fluctuates, but there are many, many people that are stepping forward at any given time who are interested in supporting us. It's been really cool in Portland, especially.
You mentioned Sisters of the Road. Any other organizations that are involved with this in a community kind of partnership with you, with books, in addition to what else?
Well, I would say that we really have such great support from a lot of different organizations, particularly the places that we go, like St. Francis has been, you know, very welcoming. Vos, the day laborers, have really welcomed us there and work with us. But Mm-hmm. So our partnerships are a little bit different than maybe you're talking about when you say a community partnership, but we definitely work closely with all the different places where we go. TPI came and talked to me on a shift about trying to do a book drive for us. We've had wonderful people do book drives just on their own volition, like the Rangers. Mm-hmm. The park rangers who all got together and brought us books and stuff. And so in that way, we've had a lot of community support and connection.
Mm-hmm. I think Israel Bayer from Street Roots also was hugely instrumental in supporting me early when it was just me writing a grant with this idea. And he's been a real stalwart supporter ever since.
What else do you think could be offered from a bicycle for the homeless populations of Portland? In addition to the books themselves, what other amenities?
Man, it's interesting because my very first fall, the end of my first summer shifts, I bought a coat for a person because I had a long kind of running relationship and carried that coat around for the next 2 months because I couldn't find him. And my fellow volunteer at the time said, listen, I think you better stick with books. And so I think that what we offer is more than the object that we hand over that's a book. We offer a conversation and a friendship and a community. And so I think that that goes beyond socks. Someone else is doing socks, you know, somebody else is doing coffee sometimes. But what we offer is greeting a person by name, recognizing someone and bringing them a book that's just for them that they asked about the week before. So that's an important part.
Well, and depending on what they pick, it could be a way to occupy a lot of time, which is something homeless people have, a lot of free time, sort of. So I imagine that people are really very happy first, second, 10th, 100th time that they've seen you. Could you give us a quick story about someone that you or who came across you for the first time and was just really thrilled that someone was bringing books around?
Do you have one that comes to mind?
I wanted to speak really first to what you also said about people having a lot of time. And I really think that that's true, but I also think that coming and meeting somebody and talking to them intellectually about common ideas, about a love of the written word, about all of these sort of interactions that many of us that live inside take for granted every day is really, really important.
How can we best support your community effort to provide books?
Well, you know, this is very exciting. On September 14th, this year, that's a Wednesday, we have a fundraiser celebration coming up. People can go to our website, which is streetbooks.org, for a link to the brown paper tickets. If they are not able to come but would like to buy a ticket to sponsor a patron, that would be great because all of our patrons come free of charge. And then the larger community that has kind of supported us through the year comes as well, and they're sort of the ticket buyers. So everyone is welcome who's ever checked out a book from us. But the larger community can help by buying a ticket and coming as well. That'd be great. Streetbooks.org.
And on Facebook also.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. That's Laura and Diane with Streetbooks. Again, you can find out more about what they do online at www.streetbooks.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after tonight's newscast for an interview with Todd Miller, author of Border Patrol Nation, about walls and other efforts to control the U.S.-Mexico border. At 6, it's Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. This week, host Adam Carpinelli interviews Chauncey Pelter about Freedom Ride 2016, a cross-country tour in solidarity with political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, increasing clouds with a low around 56. Tomorrow, patchy drizzle and fog before 11 a.m., then a slight chance of showers after 11 a.m. Cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 75. Chance of precipitation is 20%. Today in history, in 1533, the last Incan king, Atahualpa, was murdered on orders from Spanish conqueror Francisco Pizarro, and in 1842, China and Britain signed the Treaty of Nanking, ending the First Opium War and ceding the island of Hong Kong to Britain. The quote of the day is from the late actor Gilda Radner, who said, "While we have the gift of life, it seems to me the only tragedy is to allow part of us to die, whether it is our spirit, our creativity, our glorious uniqueness."
Ever since the U.S. Supreme Court, in its Citizens United ruling, granted corporations additional rights previously only available to individual living people, social justice activists have worked to overturn it. The problem is that the only way to do that is literally to pass new laws at every government level. That's where former Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb's barnstorming tour of Washington State this week comes in. Washington voters will get a chance to weigh in on this issue in November. On Tuesday, Cobb and Ruthie Engelke of the Move to Amend National Leadership Team speak at the Clark County Genealogical Society in Vancouver starting at 7 p.m. You can read more about their event on the website www.movetoamend.org. Cobb is one of the founders of the organization, which is a grassroots nonprofit organizing against. News director Lisa Loving spoke with Cobb last week about changing the law and why it matters.
For people that are new to this issue, young people, especially young voters, are there some hot button issues going on right now that are impacted by corporate personhood, just to bring it home to people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look. First, let's remember, Move to Amend began as an organization by 12 people in a living room. Today, we're over 408,000 people and growing every day. We've helped 17 states call for a constitutional amendment. And in November, voters in Washington State and California will get an opportunity to vote, so that will be 19. In addition to that, we've helped 680 communities pass resolutions of support of the idea for a constitutional amendment. But Lisa, the one I'm most proud of is that we've been on 350 ballots. That is 350 times where citizens are able to vote on whether or not they support an amendment. We've been on 350 ballots. Can you guess how many we've won?
350.
That's right, Lisa. We haven't lost yet. And of course, that includes San Francisco and Berkeley and Madison, Wisconsin, and Boston, you know, the very liberal places. But you know where else we've won? Salt Lake City, Utah. We've won in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is the hometown of Republican Tea Party Governor Scott Walker, where they haven't voted for a Democrat, much less a Green or a Socialist, in over 40 years for president or Congress in Waukesha. Move to Amend was on the ballot, and we won 70% of the votes there. We were on the ballot in Montana, one of the most politically, culturally conservative states in the union. Move to Amend was on the ballot. We won 74% of that vote. So the point I'm making, Lisa, is that by every objective measurement, what you're seeing is when people get a chance to weigh in on this, there is broad support amongst liberals, conservatives, moderates, radicals, greens, libertarians, Democrats, Republicans, independents, socialists. There is huge support for this campaign. Now I'm going to really drill down on your specific question and make it clear that this onslaught of corporate money that we're seeing in the election cycle, these super PACs, the ability for the American Legislative Exchange Council and the Koch brothers, and for that matter, George Soros on the left, the ability for these literally millionaires to try to completely control the public discourse, that is a function of the idea that corporations as persons have First Amendment protected political speech to be able to make those donations in the first place. So for anyone who recognizes that elections are becoming auctions in this country, it's not just happenstance. The concept of corporate constitutional rights is the bedrock for how they have built that. And that's the reason Move to Amend is committed to drilling down to systemic, structural, foundational change to actually make the United States of America a place where majoritarian positions become, in fact, public policy.
Okay, David, but what's the holdup then? How can we still have corporate personhood? What's going on?
Well, I'm afraid, Lisa, I'm afraid the answer is yes, because the courts have created this idea, and they have said that, and they have the support of the law and the existing political class to actually impose that. So the only way, historically, that you can address this is either the Supreme Court reconsidering and having another decision, or an amendment process. And I know that amendments are hard because they are really the foundational law. They're not just law. They're literally the framework by which our entire legal and political system operates. So at the end of the day, we have got to think of ourselves the same way the American revolutionaries did, the same way the women's suffrage movement did, the abolitionists, the trade union movement, the civil rights movement, the LGBT movement. We actually have to recognize that this is not just a legal political problem, although it is. It is at its core a cultural problem. Are we going to allow a plutocracy and an oligarchy to rule over us? I recognize that there are many things that KBOO listeners might be drawn into, from the climate justice movement to Black Lives Matter to the abolition of the prison industrial complex, the 15 Now movement. I mean, we could go down the list of all the important things that KBOO News covers day in and day out. My appeal to your listeners is this. Every one of those issues, actually within one or two steps, can touch down directly into corporate capitalism and the legal foundation of corporate constitutional rights. When we work on this issue, we open up the space for movement on all of the other issues that we actually care about. And so if a listener is already deeply engaged in any existing movement, I would never say stop doing what you're doing. I would tell her or him, thank you for what you're doing, and let's find ways to work together. But my specific appeal is to the KBOO listener who has not yet gotten involved actively in movements, and say, take a look at Move to Mend and see if this isn't worth investing time and energy in, because this is where you can make systemic transformational change. The next thing I'll say is that we have a Pledge to Amend campaign that we are running during this election cycle, Lisa, where we are going to candidates for office, from president to Congress to state legislature to city council, county commissioner, dog catcher. If you're running for office, we want to put you on notice. There is a questionnaire coming your way, and we want you to take a position. Do you support corporate constitutional rights, yes or no? Because for us, this is a which side are you on moment, and at the end of the day, we'll either have a functioning democratic republic, or we will be the generation that watches this country devolve into fascism. I wish it wasn't so stark and simple, but it is honestly how I see the critical moment that we're in.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
State election websites may be the target of hackers, according to a flash alert released earlier this month by the FBI that was leaked to an investigative reporter at Yahoo News. The bulletin notes that election division websites in two states have already been targeted, and that in one case, some data was stolen. The state was not named in the FBI document. However, in July, the state of Illinois had to shut down its voter registration system for almost 2 weeks after personal data on nearly 200,000 voters was stolen. The state of Arizona reported in June that its election site had been hacked, and though no information is known to have been stolen, some malicious code was introduced to the site. Earlier today, the Federal Department of Homeland Security hosted a conference call with state elections officials offering federal assistance in securing their data, testing for voter system vulnerabilities, and providing other resources. Earlier this month, the Electronic Privacy Information Center and Common Cause reported that 32 states and the District of Columbia allow some form of internet voting, of which only 28 require the voter to sign a waiver of her or his right to a secure ballot.
Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton has issued an executive order limiting the use of neonicotinoid or neonic-based insecticides known to be a contributing factor to honeybee colony collapse disorder, which has been wreaking havoc upon global honeybee populations. The executive order was based on a 3-year review of the impacts of neonics on pollinators conducted by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The new law will limit the use of neonics by requiring that agricultural users provide verification as to why no other insecticide will work. The new law, while the strongest in the nation, does not cover seed coatings, although the governor had called on the Minnesota state legislature to close this loophole. Nationally, 94% of all corn and up to 50% of all soy seeds are coated with a neonic spray prior to planting. A recent U.S. Department of Agriculture report stated that up to 44% of all honeybee colonies have died in the last year.
A newly issued summary report issued by the United States Geological Survey states that grizzly bear deaths in the Yellowstone area have hit an unsustainable level. It is estimated that 85 grizzlies out of the 717 known living in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem died last year. The number of deaths was not the most in a single year record keeping began in 1959. And was a 20% increase over the previous year. 25 out of the 85 grizzly deaths were reproductive-aged females, which are seen as an indicator of a species' health. Government Endangered Species Act protocols state that any number greater than 18 reproductive-aged females' deaths per year would cause a decline in the overall bear population. Of the 85 deaths, at least 19 are being actively investigated as poaching incidents. Despite the high mortality rate, the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife is continuing to develop a plan to delist the Yellowstone grizzly as an endangered species, an act that would allow sport hunting of the grizzly bear.
You've been listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamani Ward-Lewis. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Layla Yao. Our engineer is Mike Ftoklis. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH in Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Natasha Delapine. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show hosts Joe Uris talking about the outstanding weirdness of our current political scene. At 9, on Alternative Radio, hear part 2 of Ralph Nader speaking on Progressive Matters. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host DeMay Roberts talks with Tim Dang, one of the most influential Asian American Pacific Islander theater leaders in the country. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, host Joseph Galvin interviews Aaron Boberg Dotton and Christian Kennedy of the Portland Institute of the Contemporary Art about the 2016 Time-Based Art Festival. Thanks, KABU community members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate. Now stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Todd Miller, author of Border Patrol Nation, about walls and other efforts to control the U.S.-Mexican border.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Todd Miller has researched and written about U.S.-Mexican border issues for over a decade. He's worked for Border Links in Tucson, Arizona, and Witness for Peace in Oaxaca, Mexico. He currently writes on border and immigration issues for the NACLA Report on the Americas. Miller's first book, Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, was published in 2014. KABU reporter Robert Onstott spoke with Miller recently about his article last week in The Nation titled, There's a Bigger Problem at the Border Than Trump's Proposed Wall. Here's a part of that conversation.
So Todd, in your article, you point out just how absurd it is that there's all of this media sensation about the wall that Donald Trump promises to build, because there already is a massive border apparatus that functions on multiple levels. Tell us a little bit about the wall as it exists today.
Yes, it has been quite baffling for the last more than a year since Donald Trump made his announcement that he was going to build a border wall. And yeah, like you just said, one already exists. The border wall, the actual physical barrier on the actual international boundary line is about 700 miles long. It is accompanied by a strategy. The strategy is called prevention through deterrence. So the idea is that the wall, along with a concentration of agents, along with a concentration of surveillance technologies, be concentrated in areas, traditional crossing areas, for people coming north, migrants coming north, and thus they will avoid those heavily policed areas and be funneled into more desolate, dangerous, isolated places like the Arizona desert, which, according to the strategy, is supposed to be a deterrence because actually, if you look at the first policy papers, it says because it's mortal. So it's almost considered like those desolate areas are supposed to be a part of the wall, so to speak. So you have the walls, you have this with the logic of a prevention through deterrence strategy, and that's been in place since the early 1990s. And since that time, what we've seen in the last 25 years is a historic growth of the border enforcement apparatus. It's gone from practically no walls to 700 miles of walls, from 4,000 Border Patrol agents to almost 22 or 23,000 agents,